We'll talk about the top stories in state, national, and international politics in this week's edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Friday, July 19th. As we always do, we have two guests with us from different political viewpoints, and they will discuss and debate the top stories of the week. We plan on talking about what you've been hearing about in NPR all morning long, Detroit declaring bankruptcy. We'll talk about the bomber on the cover of the Rolling Stone. And we'll also talk more about the aftermath of the George Zimmerman verdict and whether or not there should be the overturning of stand your ground laws. But we also want to know, what story do you want to talk about? What happened in the news this week that you would like to hear our guests discuss? A lot of times you call in after we're done talking about something. You can call in right now with the story that mattered most to you that you want to put on the agenda for this hour. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You don't have to call in a comment about those three issues or news stories that I brought up. You can bring one up of your own. Let me welcome our guest. Louis Fortas is editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. Good morning.
Morning, Joy.
And Chris Lotto is with us, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a Republican campaign consultant. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Joy. Hello, Louis. How are you doing?
Good morning, Chris.
Well, let's start with the lead story on NPR News, Detroit declaring bankruptcy. Louis Fortas, was this a big surprise?
Well, it's the largest municipality or public institution, I should say, that has ever declared bankruptcy, and they owe something like $20 billion. And they got that's a pretty serious issue, but what happened was the conservative Republican governor, Schneider, had appointed someone who was a bankruptcy lawyer to come in and try to solve the problem. And so it's not a big surprise that it ends up in bankruptcy. But, I mean, the people that are really going to get hurt, I think, in this whole deal are the people who are certainly the retired public employees. And in the legislator and everything, you've seen, the quality of the people who go into public service, and there's some really talented people, but, either they go in that type of job in order to try to, really help do something good and not, worry about making the most money they possibly could, but also for a sense of security. And here they lose, this security, the pensions and the extended health care that they had been planning on and was in the contract or in the agreement when they worked there. They're going to really get hurt, and that's a shame. I mean, I wish there would have been a different way to handle this, and I'm not close enough to Detroit to know what other options were explored. But it's a sad thing, and I think it's going to be difficult to come out of this.
Yeah, Chris Lotto.
Well, yeah, it is unfortunate. I think it wasn't, a big secret that Detroit was in extremely rough shape economically. It's just been a city that's really a hollow shell of its former self. So it is hard to say that this is completely surprising, but it is obviously unfortunate. And it's a powerful reminder of how far our nation's economy has fallen in the last few years, and it obviously hits close to home. It's a manufacturing town, car manufacturing town. It's in the Midwest, not too far from Wisconsin. The interesting thing is I was reading the initial stories coming out last night. It's interesting how the Obama administration is actually refusing to bail the city out so far. This is a city that has seen decades of rule by the unions, by Democrats. It has truly become, as I said, a shell of its former self. The thing about President Obama is you'll recall on the campaign trail in 2012, particularly when he was heading out to Midwestern states, he was holding up Detroit as a badge of honor, saying that bailing out car companies is going to save places like Detroit and that he would not let Detroit go bankrupt. And you'll recall at the time that he and his campaign also lit into Mitt Romney when Mitt Romney said in an op-ed, let Detroit go bankrupt. So it's interesting to see that the administration now is turning its back on the city.
Is it turning its back on the city, Lewis?
I think that's a little strong language. I think the situation that we just have to see how this works out. This is the first step, and there's going to be many, many more steps. And I think we'll see what ultimately happens. But I think bailing out the auto industry, I don't think any sane human being can argue that that was a mistake. I think we preserved a major sector of, I mean, the auto started in America, and we were getting to the point where we would have been losing all of the American auto companies. And so I think what they did in terms of the bailout was necessary and extraordinarily successful. And I think as the historians look back, it'll be one of the great, you know, success stories of government intervention in helping. Government intervened in Milwaukee during the Reagan administration and essentially saved Harley Davidson. And that was a very good move also.
Well, let me touch on another economic story. Wisconsin's unemployment rate dipped slightly in June, according to the latest numbers. The new figures from the State Department of Workforce Development released yesterday show that the state's unemployment rate was 6.8% in June. That's down from 7% in May and 7.1% in April. The state gained 17,500 jobs during the month, including 7,200 positions in the leisure and hospitality sector. The manufacturing industry added 1,500 jobs. So we'll start with you, Chris Lotto. Is this good news? I mean, is Wisconsin over the hump here?
Well, it is good news. Are we over the hump? I don't know that you could go so far as to say that, but I think we're certainly heading in the right direction. If you dive a little deeper into the numbers that you just gave us, Joy, you know, this is the biggest monthly jobs gain that Wisconsin has seen since 1992. Unemployment rate for Wisconsin at 6.8% compared to the national rate of 7.6%. Wisconsin third highest in the nation for non-farm jobs over the month. Second highest growth rate. It's tied for that. So these numbers are all preliminary, but obviously are all good, encouraging signs that the jobs are coming back. We know, you know, from the political, straight up political perspective, Governor Walker promised to deliver a 250,000 jobs in his first term in office. And we also know that he has a ways to go on that promise. But if the state can continue to make gains like this, then he is definitely heading on the right direction and working hard to fulfill that promise.
So, well, Lewis, is he going to make it, you think?
First of all, I agree that the 17,000 jobs is very good. Well, if he continues at this record 17,000 a month, he probably would. But you pointed out, this is the highest number in, I think, so far in the recovery or whatever. The problem that we have is, you know, it's hard to blame the national economy or the world economy when you see the neighboring states doing much better than we are doing. And in terms of states, we're in the bottom, about 15% in terms of job growth. This is for the whole 50 states. So I think we have a long way to go. And I think it's, you know, I think the policies that that the Republicans passed over the last year and a half are a recipe for a low-wage economy. When you start breaking unions and cutting back on education and all, you are basically inviting, you know, kind of the bottom feeder companies to come here and say, to set up. You know, we're not trying to promote intelligent growth. We're looking to try to make us a competitor to Alabama and Mississippi, and I think that's a terrible economic development approach. But, I mean, that's what we have set up with the policies over the last 18 months, and they're not even working in getting those jobs. Well, you did get, you know, an increase in hospitality jobs, and those are the lowest paid. Those are entry-level jobs oftentimes.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. He's a former legislator, former economic professor at Smith College, and Chris Lotto, a former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a Republican campaign consultant. We are reviewing the news of the week, and we welcome your input. You can react to the stories that we are talking about, but we move on quickly from story to story as we are covering all the top stories in state, national, and international news in this 1 hour. You can also call in with the news story that you want to talk about. Bring it up, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You know, talking a little bit about Governor Walker's campaign pledge reminds me of a story I just heard in the news this morning from Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson. He says that two Democrats who expressed interest in running for governor say they might stay out of the race if former truck bicycle executive Mary Burke gets in. Mary Burke has not necessarily said she was going to run for governor, but it surfaced that there's some polling being done on her behalf. Now, State Senator Kathleen Vinehout, who ran for governor in the recall, said that she would think twice about getting in, and so did Malin Mitchell, the president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin and a Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor during the recall, said that he would also think twice about it. Are the Democrats going to be able to field a candidate to seriously challenge Governor Walker, Louis Fortas?
Yes.
And is Mary Burke that candidate?
Well, right now, she certainly appears to be the candidate that people are focusing on. And in the latest, I was told that there's a 90% chance that she will do this. I haven't spoken to her, and so this is all secondhand. And I think that Senator Vinehold and Malin Mitchell, I mean, both of them want to keep their name out there. And I would be very surprised if either one of them get involved. If Mary Burke is in the race, that they would get involved and challenge and have a competitive primary. So I think what they want to do is, they both have, they're both young enough to have good futures in Wisconsin politics. And I think what they're trying to do is simply keep their name out there, remind people that they are, gubernatorial material, but this time may not be the right time to run, but don't forget my name.
So do you think it's going to be Governor Walker versus Mary Burke, Chris Lotto?
Well, it's too early to say, really. But the fact that she can self-finance has to be an appealing notion for Democrats who understand that Scott Walker will have plenty of campaign resources at his disposal to run a campaign. I think, in the case of, and I heard the WPR story before we got on the air with Senator Vinehout and Malin Mitchell, I don't think they were setting anyone's world on fire, no pun intended, in the case of Mr. Mitchell. But I think that, Mary Burke is perhaps an attractive candidate. She has a business background. She has a state government background. I don't know that we know a whole heck of a lot about where she stands on things and what she would want to do as governor and what's her driving reason for potentially running. It is interesting that she called Senator Vinehout. I think that's an indication that she's certainly thinking about it. And the fact that polls are being done on her behalf shows that she's interested in it. I just don't think that, Democrats have a particularly deep bench. I don't want to say this far in advance that Scott Walker could sail to re-election. There's a lot that has to happen until election day, but Scott Walker is quite well positioned to do very well for himself in the next election. And Republicans will, come out in droves. There is that passion factor in this race that Scott Walker will have passionate supporters throughout the state of Wisconsin who will want to see him reelected.
Let's take a call from Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. I wanted to mention that I thought an interesting interview relating to Detroit. I heard over the BBC earlier today, and the guy pointed out that he thought over the long term racism did a huge amount of damage to Detroit. You can certainly fault some mayors, but when you've got a long term problem draining down a city, it can really hurt it. And he also pointed out that within suburban Detroit, i.e. part of the same Detroit metro area, the Detroit zone, so to speak, you had a lot of high-income areas. So you've got this strange mix of white, wealthy, not that far away from poor, majority, minority, and it's almost as if the racism, and being from Milwaukee, I've seen this before, where racism in terms of segregation by skin color leads to racism, or rather segregation by economics, and when you've got the pulling apart of a metro area, it leaves long-term open holes. And I know people complain about public unions, especially from the right side, but a lot of very sound local governments had state, or rather local unions for their workers and their budgets.
Yeah, Nate, I'm sorry. I need to get you to the point. So are you saying that Milwaukee is might be another Detroit in waiting, or what?
It has some concerning similarities. Yeah. I think that we're less car industry dependent, i.e. one industry, but you've got that similarity, and it's something that over the long term hopefully would get ended.
Thank you very much for those thoughts. And Louis Fortas, you're in Milwaukee too. What he thinks that maybe he's seeing some of the same issues in Milwaukee that we're facing Detroit, and racism was one of them.
And unfortunately, racism, I think, is the biggest domestic problem in the United States, and has been for certainly my whole lifetime, and much longer than that. For very, creative people that we are, we just have had tremendous problems, dealing with racism and basically putting that behind us, and we've done a very poor job on that. So, yes, that is a big problem. Also, there's a need for some kind of metropolitan government. When people are able to, cross a border and be in a more privileged community and still be able to get all the benefits of the major city, it's difficult. It's very difficult to run a city. I think the thing that you have going in Milwaukee, I think we have very good municipal government. Everybody complains about everything, but you still, when you look at the relationship between the city council and the mayor's office and that, I think by and large, I think they do quite well. And so, and we don't have the huge debt that Detroit has. So I don't see us going that direction, but I think it's tough. I think it's very, very tough to be a big city mayor in the upper Midwest or the Northeast or whatever. It's difficult.
Yep. So do you think there are similarities between Detroit and Milwaukee, Chris Slotto?
No. I mean, I think that, and the caller seemed very, very well reasoned, and obviously we appreciate him calling in. I think that Detroit, this is not something that happened overnight. I mean, it's like watching a car crash in slow motion. We've seen this coming for quite a while with Detroit, and it's really now with the announcement of the bankruptcy filing coming to a head. But, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about cities in Wisconsin, and then Madison obviously came to mind, too, as much as some of us may disagree with the politics of those leading the charge. We're a sensible state, and we have sensible municipal governments that seem to overall, by and large, over time, have managed our cities fairly well so that we're not in the deep hole that a Detroit is in. That is, we're seeing the bankruptcy coming as the culmination of, as I said earlier, decades of mismanagement and fiscal mismanagement and bad decisions. I think it's a mistake to just say that it's all about racism. I mean, I suppose you could make the argument that it plays a role, but I think the problems run much deeper than that, and that would be too simplistic to say it's all about that.
We'll talk about the race issues involved in the George Zimmerman verdict coming up as the Week in Review continues. And we continue to welcome the issues in the news this week that you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Chris Lotto and Louis Fortas on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with guests from different perspectives about the top news stories of the week. Louis Fortas and Chris Lotto are with us, and we welcome your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about the George Zimmerman verdict. He was acquitted in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin on the weekend. Since then, Attorney General Eric Holder has decried Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Stevie Wonder is boycotting the state, and protests have occurred nationwide, rallies and vigils that are pro-Trayvon Martin, saying that that justice was not served in this particular case. So was the verdict fair, Louis Fortas first?
Well, I think it's a very difficult question to answer because, number one, I don't think justice was served. I don't think someone has a right to follow someone and shoot them. At the same time, the laws have been so twisted in Florida on this issue that if you are following the law, you know, you might have had to acquit him because that they have the Stand the Ground law, which basically, if you want to kill someone in Florida, I mean, you meet them in a dark alley when there's no witnesses and you shoot them and you just say they were attacking me, they were threatening me. And, you know, according to the law, if people believe that story, you walk. So, I mean, that's a serious, even in the Old West, you know, they would at least, you know, kind of face off and draw against one another, according to the movies. But, you know, here you're basically saying, you know, someone can kill someone for, you know, threatening them or if they feel threatened. That's pretty serious. And the more important thing is that these laws just aren't, you know, coming from some legislator who woke up some morning saying, gee, I want to introduce legislation like this. These are being put together by a national organization. It's called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And this is a corporate-funded, they put together right-wing legislation, and they package it all up, and they pass it out to all the conservative legislators that join their organization. And most of the stuff that's coming, you know, that we're doing in Wisconsin, some of the serious right-wing legislation is coming from ALEC. And yeah. Robin Voss, who's speaker, used to be the Wisconsin representative for ALEC. I mean, none of this is all coordinated stuff, and that's scary.
Well, we'll talk first to Chris Lotto, your reaction to the verdict.
Sure. I mean, you know, let me just say up front, and I appreciate Louis being, you know, pretty reasonable on this issue. Of course, until we swing into ALEC, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, say up front, I don't mean that as an insult. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly complimenting you. You know, obviously, Trayvon Martin's death is unfortunate. You could say it's tragic. I mean, it's a sad situation all around. I mean, let's say that right up front. But I think that the distraction here and where people are off base, and I'm referring to Attorney General Eric Holder in particular here, since that's where we started talking about it. I mean, I think this idea of, you know, talking about the Stand Your Ground laws in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict is really it's a distraction. I mean, it's an effort to argue what I think ultimately are different issues. You know, George Zimmerman trial, he did not invoke Stand Your Ground here. And George Zimmerman was found not guilty based on the evidence that was presented at his trial. Now, the trial did not uncover any evidence that we have seen, that I'm aware of, that would support an effort to federally prosecute Zimmerman for a hate crime. You know, you have the Attorney General calling Trayvon Martin's death unnecessary. So think about that word unnecessary for a minute. I think it was chosen very carefully, because unnecessary is one thing, but the real question is whether Trayvon Martin's death was illegal. And under the laws of the state and the way the case was presented, no, that is a whole other realm of argument, and it doesn't stand up to scrutiny based on everything that we know about the case. The jury considered this case. Both sides presented their arguments. Zimmerman was found not guilty. And I think what we have now in the wake of this trial is a case where you have all kinds of groups and all kinds of people that are using it to project their own issues, whether it's regarding race or gun control or self-defense or ALEC, you name it. And unfortunately, I think you know, those efforts to pin larger issues just to the George Zimmerman trial simply don't hold water. It's kind of a mirror, a litmus test, this trial. You know, how you look at it, I think, tells you more about your own biases, worldviews, and concerns than anything that can actually be found in the case itself.
Let's take a caller. Sheree and wait. Let me bring in a caller. Sheree and Waupun. Go ahead.
Hi. I have, first of all, let me say that I have a son that lives in Florida. And literally the minute that the verdict came in, I called my son and told him to stay in the house. And I was so angry, and I understand that he was found not guilty. I understand why he was found not guilty. But, you know, to have to tell my son to stay in the house, that he can't walk down the street, you know, I don't think that many black people were surprised at the verdict. I know for one, I was disappointed, but unfortunately, I wasn't surprised. You know, it feels like we don't get represented in the court, and it's so hard to take to know that my son, if he were to get shot, that I may have no recourse, that someone will probably not go to jail if they were scared of him because he had tattoos, or because he was wearing a hoodie, or because he didn't look like he belonged in the neighborhood that he was in. I don't think that it's something that people are really talking about. The fact that you're 46 times more likely to go to jail in Wisconsin if you have marijuana, if you're black, and if you're white, that's something that is so ingrained in our system. And people, it's really exposed right now. And I feel exposed and vulnerable, you know, just being black in America. And I never felt that way. Well, I've never felt this way, this dramatically, until this verdict. It really rocked my world. It changed. It changed the way that I looked at Wisconsin and America.
Yeah, if Zimmerman wasn't armed and on neighborhood watch and thought Trayvon Martin looked suspicious, he wouldn't have been initially pursuing him, and this confrontation would not have happened. Chris Lotto, what's your reaction to hearing Sheree's comment?
Well, I'm certainly, you know, moved by her comments. She's obviously coming from a place of what she feels is legitimate concern for her family, and that is understandable. That is her reaction to the verdict. I mean, I'm not going to deny that this is a verdict in a trial that has inflamed passions on both sides, and I think the caller just now is really driving that point home. I think, you know, you have to take a step back and look at the case itself and what its larger meaning is. And, you know, perhaps this does, as Lewis pointed out earlier, perhaps it does open up a dialogue towards stand your ground laws and lead to changes, lead to, you know, people taking a second look at this. But again, this particular case, the Zimmerman case, did not hinge on stand your ground. And it's important to note that. So we can have all these other discussions that we want, but I think, again, circling back to the Zimmerman case itself, a lot of these things that are being brought up really aren't factors that play into this particular trial in this particular case. But I mean, obviously what your caller had to say was quite moving, and you know, it's understandable. I mean, we're seeing folks protesting in cities across the country here, so this is clearly a case that has inflamed passions. The question is whether it's coming from the right place, and I don't know that the facts of this trial and the way it went down support that.
All right, have at it, Lewis.
I certainly am sympathetic to what the caller had to say, and I respectfully totally disagree with Chris. I think this can't be taken in isolation. You can't, you know, take away the fact that there's very strong, you know, racism in this country. You can't take away that Alec is putting together these pieces of legislation that enable someone to quote stand their ground. This is you can't look at it in isolation. It's all of these factors impinge on this, and how much no one knows. But despite the fact that stand the ground wasn't apparently brought up in court, in terms of the jury instructions, it was used. And when the jury was given instructions, stand the ground law. The implications of that and the law actually were part of the jury instruction. So, yes, it did have an impact. But, I mean, the main thing is it's very, very tragic, and it was totally unnecessary. I mean, and he was pretty clearly profiled, and even though they didn't use it in the court, he was racially profiled. And I think everyone knew that, and no one, said it. And so, no, this is not something that's done in isolation. This is... This is a function of our society. And the problem that you have is when you go into a recession or a depression, it brings out kind of the worst in people. And we've had five rough years, and people are angry, and people are, you know, protecting their property. And hopefully as the economy gets better, people's better sides will be coming out.
Well, let's move on to another issue that got a lot of attention over the past couple of days. Rolling Stone's most recent cover features the accused Boston Marathon bomber. It's drawn fire from Boston residents and people across the nation, for that matter. Supermarkets and drugstores are boycotting the magazine. A lot of people say this glamorized this terrorist. Chris Lotto, did that magazine make a big mistake or what?
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to admit, first of all, I've been a subscriber to Rolling Stone off and on, more on than off, for really more than 20 years. So, you know, this is far from the first time that the politics of Rolling Stone magazine and its writers and editors have left me steaming. I've always found their writing illustrative of how the left thinks, so therefore it has its place. I mean, I like to read what the other side's thinking. But, you know, I'm sure they're thrilled that they've been able to stir outrage and gain attention as part of, you know, printed magazine, a dying medium, so they've got people talking about Rolling Stone, but you know the cover is beyond tacky, and I think shows a really alarming degree of insensitivity to, you know, the victims here, the real victims, not the bomber who, you know, he grew up in you know, a family that turned his back on whatever the cover says. You know, he's not the victim. The victims are the families and the friends of those killed and injured in Boston. You know, a city and a nation, really, that's still kind of coping with this horrific bombing. And to put, you know, this baby face picture up of this bomber, you know, that in a wordless way sort of holds him up as some kind of hero is appalling. But again, it's, you know, Rolling Stone swings that way every once in a while, and I wish I could say it was an isolated thing, but that's kind of the way they operate. I mean, yes, there's freedom of the press. I think it's just a scummy way to sell magazines, and I think it's understandable that people are voting with their wallets and looking to boycott Rolling Stone.
Lewis?
Yeah, we have to put together a cover every week, and it's a powerful instrument for the newspaper. We have this, you know, our newspaper sits in almost 1,200 locations in the Milwaukee area with this cover, you know, for 6 days while people pick up the paper until the rack is empty. And so you put a lot of thought into doing that cover, and I'm sure they put a ton of thought into this. I think the idea of the article, which I haven't read because I don't subscribe to Rolling Stone, but if it's an article, from what I read about the article, it's basically how did this, you know, young kid, you know, turn in this terrible direction. That's a very legitimate article, and but you don't. I would never do a cover like that. I think it is totally insensitive. I think it's defeating the purpose. I just think if you want to make a point, I think it's really important to try to figure out what does radicalize some of these young Muslim men. That's very, very legitimate, but don't sensationalize it by doing what they did. So I'm disappointed, and I think they probably are very sorry they did that cover right now. But we'll see how they respond to it next time.
Well, a Massachusetts state police officer responded to that cover by releasing never-before-seen photos of the Boston bombing suspect when he was arrested in the boat. The photos show him being taken into custody. He was bloody and bruised, and you could see a sniper's light on his forehead with a gun pointed at him. This Sergeant Sean Murphy is a tactical photographer with the state police. He has apparently been relieved of his duties, maybe as they investigate this. Do you have a reaction to that, Lewis Fortas?
Well, Again, I go back to the fact that covers are powerful because they sit there and people walk by and a lot more people see it than actually read a publication or that particular publication. So I think you may have free speech, but you also have to have some, you know, discretion and some, you know, common decency, and you know, you may have free speech, but again, you can't yell fire in the crowded theater, as as the courts have determined. It's the same thing here. You might have free speech, but, geez, you really have to go that far. It's the same thing when they were printing, when newspapers were printing the images of Mohammed or whatever that was causing all the trouble in Europe, and the newspapers, you know, a number of newspapers continued to do that. I just thought that was so unnecessary. I mean, if you're that desperate, then maybe your business isn't doing too well in other areas.
Any quick react, Chris Lotto, to the police officer releasing those photos?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but it's pretty obvious that he was acting from a place of anger and passion. And you're right, I understand that he apparently lost his job over it as well. I do want to give credit where credit's due. Lewis and the Shepherd Express managed to fire me up just about every week when I walk past the magazine and at the O'Connell Walk Pick and Save. So job well done, sir.
All right, let's. We have lots of other issues to talk about, so let's move on. After the break, we'll talk about a number of court cases in Wisconsin involving capital protests, involving Wisconsin's new abortion law. We'll have the latest on the armed guards for the Wisconsin mine. Many more issues to talk about as the Week in Review continues. Talking with Chris Lotto, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a Republican campaign consultant, and Lewis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee, a former state legislator, former econ professor at Smith College. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Ann Strain Champs and 45 North. Coming up after 10, bugs and dirt are good for you. So that's so says Ann's guest after 10 o'clock on 45 North. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to The Week in Review. Time now for our Week in Review quiz. USA Today is holding a contest to find the best iconic American food in the United States. Along with Maryland crabs and Southern fried chicken and Philly cheesesteaks, what Wisconsin food is in the running? What is the best regional food in the United States, according to USA Today? What Wisconsin food is in the running? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll give you about 5 minutes or so to call in your answers. We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will win a book from the books we featured on the program recently. And we will announce the answer and the winner at the end of this edition of The Week in Review. Well, let's talk about some state news now. A federal judge extended the hold on a portion of Wisconsin's most recent abortion bill. Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Wisconsin have sued to stop the state from requiring doctors at abortion clinics to have hospital admitting privileges. This provision would force two of Wisconsin's four abortion clinics to close down, one in Appleton, one in Milwaukee. So, Chris Lotto, do you think that this law that requires women to have ultrasounds and these hospital admitting privileges will ultimately be upheld?
That's hard to say. I think that you'll see court challenges on this one coming for quite a while, and this is one of those cases that will likely drag on for months, if not years. I mean, what the sponsors and supporters of the law are saying, the way they're making their case, is that when a woman is choosing whether to get an abortion, this law helps ensure that the woman's getting all the information available to make an informed decision, and that the person performing the abortion would have the admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the abortion facility. So the stated goal is to ensure that if complications arrive, the hospital is close enough and the abortion provider can ensure proper continuity of care to make sure that the patient is properly, adequately cared for. It's basically putting a medical safeguard in place that that ultimately does nothing to limit the actual ability to get an abortion in Wisconsin. It's a choice that will still be available to women, but is really helping to protect those patients and ensure that their health and well-being is a priority, you know, as part of an abortion procedure. But again, this is a case that is we're going to see a lot of arguments over this, and this is something that in all likelihood is going to wind down for a number of months.
Louis Fortas?
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that Chris said that the people arguing for this law, and this is their argument, because he stated their argument very well. But I think realistically, this is another one of these bills that is circulating around through the kind of the right-wing legislative world and being introduced in a variety of states. And so it's, again, not a homegrown Wisconsin idea by any stretch of the imagination. But the thing that I think everyone has to begin to question is, you know, the same legislators that are supporting legislation like this are the same ones who complain about, you know, government getting in my way and we need to keep government out of our lives and you can't stop me, the government can't stop me from carrying my gun anywhere I want or whatever. But it's okay for the government to start interfering in one of the most personal aspects of someone's life, and that is, you know, a woman's decision, you know, to carry a baby to term. So don't they realize the hypocrisy? Don't they realize the contradiction? I mean, this has nothing to do with you know, saving or protecting a woman's life. This is just another, you know, right-wing ideological action.
We have a caller on this topic, Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I've been watching this going on in Wisconsin and Texas and the other red states, and I think, you know, we've got a perfect storm coming affecting women's health. In the name of ending abortions, these legislators, mostly men, are closing down Planned Parenthoods. If these girls and women can't get abortions, this is where they would go for their primary care. At the same time, these same states are turning down Obamacare money, and then they want to end food stamps. I'm not sure if somebody could explain this to me and explain it maybe in the context of Christianity, I'd appreciate it.
Well, Chris, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, she just threw a lot on the table. I mean, I can only explain it from the perspective of Catholicism, which is abortion is wrong in all cases. So, I mean, if she wants to look at it from a religious perspective, that's a slippery road to go down, and I guess it depends on what your belief structure is, religiously speaking. I think, again, you know, going back to the point I made earlier, this is not something that prohibits abortions in this state. It is really a medical safeguard more than anything else, and just turning the focus back to Wisconsin. You know, that option to get an abortion still exists in Wisconsin. You know, I've always been a little bit troubled by the abortion debate because I think, you know, we all have our sides that we're on in this issue. And it is a sensitive issue, and it's obviously an important issue, but I think it kind of is used sometimes as a distraction to talk about other issues that may be more important and may be more pressing. Again, not to minimize the importance of abortion, but I think, you know, we've all kind of dug in on our sides on this one, and it's kind of hard to get one perspective to see the other's perspective and even change their mind. So I'm not going to attempt to do that with the caller because I think that's a fool's errand.
Yeah, just the caller did bring up Texas. Texas Governor Rick Perry did cap off nearly a month of intense media coverage and legislative debate. He signed the bill that bans all abortions in the state after 20 weeks of pregnancy, as well as some of these provisions that are in Wisconsin's law. Louis Fortas?
Again, this is one of these bills are going through all the legislatures because they are manufactured somewhere else and being distributed. But Chris says this doesn't eliminate or end abortion in Wisconsin, and that's absolutely correct because they can't, because there still is Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court decision. But they're doing everything they can to make it more difficult. And this will probably close down if this stays if this law stays intact, it will probably force the closure of some abortion clinics. And I mean, this goes back to when I was in the legislature. I mean, they started with parental consent and they had the 24-hour waiting period, and it's just one after another. They just keep cutting away at it because they can't, because of the Supreme Court ruling, eliminate abortion, but they can do everything in their power, and they are doing everything in their power to try to limit it.
Well, protesters continue to assemble at the state capitol, mainly the Solidarity Singers, in groups of more than 20 without getting a permit, which is the number that was set by a judge's ruling last week. He said that the state could not require a permit for a group of four protesters, but he put the number at 20. So are they in the right, Louis Fortas, going there without the permit?
I think so. Again, the Capitol was always the people's house. I mean, people would come there to express themselves, whether it's testifying before an assembly or Senate committee, or sitting in the balcony watching the proceedings, or setting up their tables in the Capitol, passing out literature for whatever. I mean, it is the town square. It's you know what the ancient Greeks had in their forums there in. And so now what they're saying is that the people that want to demonstrate have to go to the people that are oftentimes the target of the demonstration and ask for their permission to get a permit to demonstrate. You know, there's something wrong here. This sounds like something coming out of, you know, Putin's Russia or what's going on in China, where, you know, if you don't like what the opposition is doing, you don't just, you know, you don't debate with them or whatever, you just squash them. And that's what, you know, or curb their rights. And we're not quite arresting people yet, but, you know, we're doing everything we, you know, up to that point where you're just stopping people from expressing their views.
So, Chris Lotto, should we be arresting those singers?
Well, police and a federal judge are saying this is an unlawful assembly and that larger events such as this require a permit. Simple as that. So these folks can still assemble in groups of, I believe, 20 or less. Otherwise, they have to go through the permitting process. And again, this is another one of those matters that's still working its way through the courts. But it really is a matter of public safety and a matter of keeping things safe and organized at the state capitol. I mean, this is a place where hundreds of people work. You know, thousands of people likely visit it every week. School kids are there visiting on a regular basis. These demonstrators are making a conscious choice to ignore the law. They're basically asking for trouble. No one is denying them the right to protest.
We don't have enough time to talk about any more issues. We will talk about more of these state issues in our state capitol report on Monday between 7 and 8. Well, time now to congratulate Randy in Wisconsin Rapids. He is the winner of the Week in Review quiz. We asked which Wisconsin food is a candidate in USA Today's Best Iconic American Foods contest. The answer, cheese curds. Wisconsin cheese curds are in the running for the best iconic American food, competing with Philly cheesesteaks, wild salmon, southern fried chicken, and others. USA Today is inviting votes until Monday on its website. So, cheese curds, no contest, Louis Fortas?
I was trying to guess which one, and that did not come across my my mind.
What about you, Chris Lotto? Do you think cheese curds are the best iconic American food?
Oh, absolutely. I'm thrilled to hear that. Actually, you know, it's funny. Whenever I'm traveling and bring up the idea of fried cheese curds, which is even better than cheese curds, in my opinion, I get looks from people who just can't believe that we fry cheese in this state. And I tell them, look, you have no idea how delightful it is until you've tried it. So, you know, get out to the fair and enjoy it.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you, are you going to have some sort of, you know, an Elvis Sunday or something, Chris, at the fair?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I saw that story in our list of stuff, and I'll tell you, the items just get more outrageous every single year. My chest tightened just reading that list, and, you know, the idea of a deep-fried Snickers bar seems positively, quaint by comparison to what they're going to have on the menu this
year. Yeah, lots of bacon and chocolate. Louis Fortas, are you going to go to the fair?
Oh, of course. Bacon's the hot setup these last few years.
It is.
They have bacon fests in cities and...
We got to leave it there because we're out of time. Thanks to both of you very much for being with us. Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, and Chris Lotto, former communications director of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.